I did what was now called data journalism as a journalist, you know, back in the dark ages, going back to the 1980s. You know, people thought, computers, journalism, that's the dumbest idea I ever heard.
Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Monday, April 29th. I'm Stephen Overly. And that was journalist Ira Chinoy. And he's being modest here. Ira didn't just do data journalism. He has twice been part of reporting teams that won the Pulitzer Prize. And then he went on to teach journalism at the University of Maryland. That's where I first met him, as my professor well over a decade ago. But I didn't call Ira up to talk about our old times. I wanted to talk about a reporting project that's been 20 years in the making.
I got interested in how computers and journalism first hooked up, and I was stunned to find out it went back 70 years.
Back to election night, 1952.
I pulled on that thread, and I knew there was a great story there after a first few discoveries.
That's the subject of Ira's new book, Predicting the Winner, The Untold Story of Election Night 1952 and the Dawn of Computer Forecasting. On the show today, Ira takes me back to that pivotal election night and what it tells us about political journalism and technology today. Ira, welcome to the Politico Tech Podcast.
I'm happy to be here, Stephen. It's great.
Yeah, it's surreal to have you on. You were there from the very beginnings of my journalism education.
Indeed, you were a rock star, Stephen. You set a very high bar, so it's great.
I love to hear that. We won't get into how far I maybe have fallen, but I think I'm still doing my best and applying everything I learned. Listen, I want to dig into this book that you've written. Take me back to election night 1952. What was so novel about the first use of these so-called fearsome contraptions, you know?
And
they're used to kind of predict election winners.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take you back 4 years before that to election night 1948, which is somewhat famous in American history because it's the one in which pollsters really got things upside down and the journalists followed along with them. And that's the one where they predicted that, you know, Truman was going to lose and Truman won.
Right.
And so we have this famous picture of Truman holding up a newspaper, you know, saying that he'd been defeated by his opponent. So that by the time we get to 1952, the journalists are very concerned to get it right. And also in 48, the New York Times TV critic, which was a brand new job in journalism also, panned the networks for their lackluster presentation of returns. So when we get to 1952, the TV news managers wanted a couple things. They wanted anything that might give them an edge in calling the election, and they wanted something that would attract viewers. Today, we would call it eyeballs or clickbait or something like that.
They had to put on a show.
They put on a show. So they thought that these computers with their blinking lights and all that kind of stuff would attract viewers, whether or not they did something right. So the computer industry was also new, really brand new, and computer makers were trying to interest the public in computers, and because this was going to be a business for them. And so they, you know, these two sides kind of came together, and the computer people and the TV people teamed up to do this on election night. And CBS did it using a gigantic 8-ton computer that was so big it could not be moved from the factory floor where it was built in Philadelphia.
That was one detail I found so fascinating, was like the first computer to appear on CBS News on election night was actually a prop.
Because
the real one couldn't be there.
It couldn't be there. So they took this operator console for the next UNIVAC that was going to be built. They put it on the set. They hooked it up to something like a Christmas tree light timer so that there'd be a lot of blinking lights, but it's not the place where the work was being done.
That's crazy.
NBC teamed up with what was primarily a calculating machine company out of New Jersey, the Monroe Calculating Machine Company, that was also dipping its toes into the computer world and had manufactured a much smaller computer called the Monrobot that was the size of an office desk and could be moved right into the NBC studio. So we had not only competing computers, we had really competing visions of what computing would be.
on that election night, 1952, what exactly were these computers doing? They were crunching voter data at the time, or and sort of were they predicting the future and how other precincts would vote? What exactly were they being tapped to do?
Right. Well, by that point, there was 100 years of history of newspaper editors knowing how to read early returns to predict what would happen in an election. Early returns are generally random, right? They're not representative. But if you have full returns from a particular precinct or a particular county, you can match that to what, you know, what happened 4 years and 8 years earlier. So that was an old science. The computers had the ability to just crunch a whole lot more data. But the fundamental idea was not brand new. They had to come up with algorithms. They had to write the programs. So they were, as returns came in, it was being fed to Philadelphia in one case, to the crew at NBC at Rockefeller Center, Studio 8H, where, you know, Saturday Night Live is filmed now.
It's filmed now, yeah.
And yeah, so the aggregate numbers were going into the computer and they were using it to compare to the past, a much more elaborate program in the UNIVAC, and use that to predict states that hadn't even come in yet to get this sort of big general picture.
Upon reflection, I mean, how well did those first computers do at accurately predicting how the country would vote?
Well, they did on that night, they did really well. But things didn't work out as planned. And so one of the really interesting things that happened is that behind the scenes, the UNIVAC spit out relatively early in the evening a prediction that Eisenhower would win by a landslide, that he would get 438 electoral votes. And the computer engineers didn't believe it because the pollsters, trying not to repeat their errors of 1948,
had
predicted a very close election, very close election. And so they thought, we must be wrong. And they had planned for every possible contingency, except what if the computer spit out a prediction that turned out to be right and it wasn't believed? So they didn't release that right away to CBS. And there's sort of a long story about how eventually a prediction did get on air. But that's a real case of what you see is really colored by what you expect to see. It wasn't believed by the engineers and the programmers, but they came pretty well. I mean, that first prediction out of the UNIVAC was only 4 electoral votes off from what the final count was.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was a landslide. In each case, it was well over 400 electoral votes, which today is like, I don't know, last time we saw an election that was quite like that. It would take a while for two things to happen, for the algorithms to really be refined and for TV journalists and TV reviewers and TV critics to accept that this was journalism, that this is something that would be part of election night. We can't imagine an election night without computers now.
Right.
We can't imagine it. But in 1952, the response was, no, that's just dumb. You know, like, no, why would we want to do that? And so it took time. We have to appreciate what a jump that was, what a gamble they were taking on both sides, the computer makers and the journalists, to do that.
You know, you mentioned how it's hard for us to conceptualize an election night without technology, which is completely true. I mean, you turn on CNN or MSNBC, right? It's like they're moving maps of the U.S. They're pulling up real-time data on individual precincts. I mean, it's so tech-driven now. But yet, and this is sort of the irony to me, even as the technology has gotten so much more sophisticated, like the crisis of credibility that inspired all of this still remains and maybe has worsened, some could argue, right?
Right. Well, to be fair, the election night forecasts over the years waxed and waned in their accuracy, right? And things were added. People would be interviewed leaving the polling place. And so that kind of information would be added. But when we get to 2020, if it's okay to talk about that,
yeah.
We get to 2020. And I have a final chapter in the book that's basically is a thought experiment that asks, where do we go from 2020? And it was not a chapter that I envisioned would be how I would end this book when I was writing it, because I thought this was a book about innovation. But one of the things that really came to me was that going forward from 2020, the answer is not going to be better math, and that there really are these two things that are going on. You referenced one of them, which is trust. And until we in journalism and society at large solve this trust problem, you know, declining trust in the news media, we're going to still have a hard time on election night. And the other is the rise of these things called news deserts. Mm. And news deserts are these black holes in the information cosmos where there's little or no local news. And one of the really shocking numbers from a study that was done in 2022 at Northwestern by a researcher named Penny Abernathy is that some 70 million Americans, one-fifth of the American population, lives in a news desert that has little or no local news. We also know that people trust local news more than they trust any other kind of news. It's the thing that they trust the most. And the decline in trust has been dramatic. I think it's very connected to this issue of election night, which is to say, if there's a news desert, if you're not getting any local news from something you trust, that's a place where social media and disinformation and kind of these news bubbles can work their way in and really corrupt people's understanding of what's going on, understanding of people who aren't like them.
I think that's a fascinating point because, you know, it seems like in 1952, they had this perception that bringing in this technology would breed more trust in the results, right? And
right.
The reality we know today, based on how technology has played out, is that it's much more a double-edged sword, where while technology has allowed for more transparency, faster information, etc., it's also allowed for disinformation and
right.
You know, propaganda that undermines credibility. And so I wonder if looking at the history, if you found a through line or a takeaway from how dependent election prediction has become on technology itself.
Well, I mean, that's a great question, all right? And is it the technology or is it what goes into the technology? I think, you know, technology is not a thing that lives outside of history. It doesn't live outside of human action with it. And so it really has to do with who's doing the programming, how good is the data, how much attention are they paying to whether errors can creep in. So I don't fault the technology so much as how people are anticipating it's going to be used. And just like you, every election night, I'm tuned in. I'm, you know, watching Steve Kornacki on, you know, MSNBC. I'm listening to John King on CNN, whatever it is, right?
I'm
right there. But those broadcasts aren't reaching a lot of people who need good information, you know, or living inside some other kind of information bubble. So I think sometimes there's an underappreciation of what can and can't be done with technology, the good that can be done and the harm that can be done. And it's not a value-neutral proposition using technology.
You know, there was something you wrote in the book where you said, the lessons learned from election night in 1952, quote, tell us something worth remembering when the next chance to innovate comes along. And it seems to me that, like, that next chance to innovate is here. You know, newsrooms are grappling with artificial intelligence in a major way. We talk about that all the time on the podcast. What does history tell us that you think newsrooms can apply to AI?
To AI. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, and just to go back a little bit there, I think the lessons of 52 have a lot to do with the power of collaboration outside the area of expertise, right? Outside of the usual suspects in journalism. And I can talk a little bit more about that. I think an AI is going to be a powerful tool. And I think it is something that could be explored mm-hmm. to ask, you know, how could we use this on election nights, not so much to get a better picture, but to reach enough people to get them to understand these results are accurate. And that part of it has to be set in motion well ahead of election night. But I think AI is a powerful tool. I know where I am at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at Maryland, where you were, you know, we have lots of people on the faculty who are going at this now, trying to understand how it can be used in journalism, what the pitfalls are, how do we take this forward instead of running back to be kind of victims of the future? How can we use this as a tool to do better? And so I would think that election nights have always, always been a place to roll out technological innovations back to the dawn of radio and, you know, you name it. And so election nights, because they attract a lot of attention, are possibly a place where that can be done.
You know, you do talk about sort of election nights being this outsized opportunity for innovation and for trust building. We have an election coming up in November. What do you think is at stake, or what's the opportunity in 2024?
I think the opportunity is we begin right now to understand, okay, this is going to sound crazy, right? This will sound as crazy as it was in 52 for people to use computers. I think we have to understand why people are willing to live in a fact-free world. We have to understand why people are willing to accept stuff that just isn't true and isn't factual. You know, there have been, Sarah Longwell is a conservative pollster and someone who studies that, and she did some focus groups after the 2020 election to understand why are people still holding on to the big lie, you know, the idea that the election was stolen.
Right.
And they couldn't really point to anything factual. It was just like an idea, right? They just had a feeling about it.
Right.
She called it sometimes almost a tribal pose. There are other researchers who find that you can intercede in that. You can, if you feed people, if you give people stuff that's factual from a trusted source, they can be weaned away from this adherence to crazy town ideas. But it's more than you can do on election night. It's something that really needs to be studied, understood. And I don't mean to say that people who vote for one candidate or another need to have their heads examined. I'm particularly talking about this subset of people who just will not believe that the sky is blue, right?
Right.
And that the sun gives us heat and light, that just, you know, won't believe it. And so I think we really have to understand that in order to move ahead.
Well, Ira, Professor Chinoy, I thank you for joining us on the Politico Tech podcast.
You are more than welcome.
Tell us the name of the book and when it comes out.
Right. The book is called Predicting the Winner, The Untold Story of Election Night 1952 and the Dawn of Computer Forecasting. And the official publication is now April 30th, but it's actually out.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.